Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
Oh, yeah, Sean Spicer coming up here in just a couple of minutes on 97.1 FM Talk. We'll do some politics, obviously, with Mr. Spicer. I was trying to see, we have John O'Leary coming up at the bottom of the hour. John had to cancel because he was on an airplane on Friday when our interview was set, and he hooked us up with the fine young actor from St. Louis who plays his roommate and best friend in the film. The film that is based on his story, Soul on Fire, opened up on Thursday. And it's a great inspirational story. I think a lot of people here in St. Louis know it. One of the unique things about this film is that it was filmed in St. Louis. You're going to see things like the MAC and other neighborhoods where I was trying to think of a movie that has been more St. Louis-centric with all of the shots. You know, the Arch is in there a couple of times. So it made $3 million over the weekend. That is not, you know, your greatest box office. But for a movie like this, I don't think it's terrible. I mean, The Rock's movie from the week before made $5 million, right?
Right.
So $3 million here. But this is even more encouraging, all right? Because, you know, here's what happens, and I'll kind of explain this because I was in the critic world. So in the critic world, you are given an opportunity in many situations, but not all, to see the movie before it is released. Right. They do screenings on a Tuesday. A lot of times I would go to Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. This is one of the reasons I got out of it, because I got busy with my daughter. So in order for a critic, and we used to have one of those at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. We had a couple of them. They don't have them anymore. Joe Williams, who's a friend. Joe and I, we didn't agree on anything politics, but we had a lot of great movie conversations, and he was an excellent film critic. He really was. I think that people in St. Louis had no idea how good Joe was. Now, having said that, Joe in the Trump era might have been a little different, because he passed away, I think, before Trump might have been elected. And believe me, his politics were way to the left. But what was I talking about, Sue?
The movies and about.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So what the critics then do is that, okay, well, we're going to review this film because Sony gave us the opportunity to see us, and we have enough time to put a review together, and then it comes out on Friday. Well, when they don't do that, and I don't think they did it with Soul on Fire, then you only have a handful of critics that have maybe even seen it or taken time to go out to the theater. I bring this up because it did not have, now I'll check right now, maybe it has a Rotten Tomatoes score. But more important than that, it had an A on the audience score. So even though it might not have, you know, made a lot of money, the A grade on the part of the audience says something. It's an A grade on CinemaScore, and that's something that is excellent. And what happens with a movie like that so often is you'll get word of mouth, which is what I think they're hoping for. And it'll find a life on streaming platform. But again,
oh, yeah.
$3 million does not sound like a lot of money, but for a low-budget movie and for a CinemaScore that's A, That's not too bad. But we'll get John's perspective on that coming up here at the bottom of the hour. I will also have an audio cut of the day. Right now, he's back with us, does a podcast, the host of the Sean Spicer Show, available anywhere where you listen to your podcast. Mr. Spicer back with us this evening to talk about a variety of things. How are you, Sean?
I am fantastic. It's think about this weekend. We got this world peace, you know, deal, accord, that's monumental. Navy won. 32-31. The Patriots. Well, I mean, I had one heck of a weekend. The Navy's 250th birthday is today.
Yeah.
I mean, what? And I got Winsome Sears on my show tonight. people can go to my YouTube channel. But I mean, Mark, I'm riding high. It's Columbus Day. Wow.
It is. What a day. You know, two things about all that. Unfortunately, my Missouri Tigers could not win against Alabama, although it was a good game. So I'm not quite on the high that you are from football. But it is, as you indicate, it's Columbus Day again, right? It's not Indigenous Peoples Day. We've gone back to Columbus Day. So that's a good thing. And look, you know, when it comes to the peace deal, Sean, I'm sure you've seen this today. All credit to Joe Biden and Tony Blinken, right? It's all because of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I get a kick out of it. It's just, even Hillary Clinton thanks President Trump. That tells you how bad the left is suffering. When Hillary can bring herself to admit that President Trump did something like this, and the rest of them can't. But I feel bad for Antony Blinken. I really do. I saw that post where he's like, hey, he built it off the Biden plan. And I'm like, I didn't even know that Biden had a plan, never mind one for the Middle East.
Right. Right. That, yeah, that's a good point. So what do you think here? I mean, look, this is quite remarkable. You see, it's very sad that, you know, when you hear the number 48 hostages, that unfortunately only 20 are alive. So that's unfortunate. You go back to the horrors of what happened 2 years ago on October 7th, which are just unspeakable. And it looks like President Trump had kind of Hamas boxed in. They didn't really have a choice here, did they?
Well, they didn't, and that was the beauty of it. The sort of asymmetrical, outside the box thinking of this. They're bringing in the Arab countries, utilizing advisors, the British Foreign Secretary, who's apparently got a ton of insight into this. So this really was three dimensional chess by getting all the people together, making sure that everyone had some equity in the deal. Again, there's a sense of brilliance there, and what it continues to remind me, Mark, is that the same old thinking that pervades Washington, D.C. on whether it's domestic policy or foreign policy, you just got to get thrown out the window and saying, hey, how can we do things better?
Which is great. It's awesome.
Oh,
it really
God.
Is. Yeah. And it's refreshing. Now, I don't know if the Democrats will have it in them to say nice things. John Fetterman has. And you know, he's the only guy that says says things that are making sense over there. But it'll be interesting to see. I heard from a Jewish American listener the other day, because I had Democrats on my show on Friday on my Reardon Roundtable that I do. And, you know, I don't know, certainly she's not speaking for all Jewish Americans, but it is going to be interesting to see how many of those give credit to, you know, there's people who are Jewish, I'm sure, here in St. Louis who have TDS. But this person was telling me they're done with it because they're sick of, you know, Republicans being called Nazis when they know the real implications of what Nazis did to the Jews during the Holocaust. So that really turned her off. But I'm wondering the political implications of this moving forward. Obviously, positive for President Trump, even though it's going to be very difficult for them to admit that.
Yeah, but there's like, look, I think there's a group of people that can never be assuaged in any way. And they're just so hell-bent on Trump being responsible for you know, rainy days. There's nothing that he could do, and you've got to just take that block and put it away. And then there's this group in the middle that I think slowly but surely is coming over to recognize that it may not be a traditional mode of governance, but he gets the job done. And frankly, I keep going back to something that President Trump said, I think during the transition, where he's like, it's not Republican, it's not conservative, it's just common sense. And I look at like NATO, tariffs, and I go, doesn't this just make sense to you? Like, why would we have agreed to the following, you know, ever in the past? And I don't know if it's, like I said, I don't look at it as a conservative policy or a, you know, or immigration for that matter. Whoever thought that like securing the border and making sure that you had to come in legally made sense, right? There's a lot of things that are happening where it's not like this is some massive conspiracy thing or right-wing propaganda. It's just stuff that makes sense.
Sean Spicer back with us this afternoon. Let me kind of move on to some other things. You mentioned Winsome Sears. I love Winsome Earle Sears. I think she's awesome. I had her on a couple of years ago when she wrote her book. She has been trailing Abigail Spanberger in this race in Virginia for governor. I'm seeing some new polling out today that's showing that this is tightening, and certainly it has to be, I would think, related to the whole Jay Jones stuff in the last couple of weeks. I cannot believe, you know, there's a lot of thing in politics that I can't believe. I cannot believe that the Democrats, Tim Kaine and others, did not have it within them to say, yeah, that's kind of automatically disqualifying for the top law enforcement person in Virginia, Jay Jones, to be saying those things in text messages and over the phone. I mean, how can they stick with that guy?
Oh, it's actually easy. So I actually asked Winsome this earlier. when she was on my show. So backing up, Robert Cahaley, who is the head of Trafalgar Group,
right,
which is one of the best polling outfits out there, was on my show on Friday. And Jim McLaughlin, by the way, will be on the show tomorrow. So we're like going all in on New Jersey and Virginia polling. And and Cahaley basically said, hey, look, the erosion is really at upper on the older, you know, in this case, Commonwealth of Virginia voters, because they're watching TV and they're seeing stuff. But where it's not having as much movement is younger voters who are getting their information, you know, online, et cetera. And so I told Winsome that. I said, listen, you've got to start really getting out with influencers, digital, places where younger voters that may not have heard about this as much are seeing the impact of it. But here's why I can answer the mail on the question you asked. So in 2019, I guess, former Governor Ralph Northam wore blackface.
Right,
and
that's right.
Abigail Spanberger and others, prominent Democrats, called on him to resign. And then they're not doing it for Jay Jones. Well, what's the through line? Because I started to think to myself, why is this different? What's different is that the black vote is a huge constituency for the Democratic Party. And so in 2019 or whatever it was, when Governor Northam wore blackface, it made sense to call him out because it endeared you to the black vote to say, see, I'm standing up for, you know, against this type of behavior.
Right.
And hopefully and this time, though, they don't want to offend Jay Jones because he is, obviously he's the black. He's on the ticket. She's a white woman. So she doesn't want to offend them. So they'll just do whatever they have to appease, you know, certain what they believe certain constituencies want them to do or say. I frankly don't think this is a black, white, you know, racial issue. I don't think no matter who you are that you would want to defend somebody, not just shooting your opponent, but then saying that I want his wife to watch his dead child lie in
right.
their arms. I
mean, yeah.
That's pretty sick thinking, right?
Yeah,
I told people, like, it's one thing to say, you know, Mark, I'm so mad at you, I could kill you. That's sort of inappropriate, maybe off, you know, tone deaf, whatever. But when you literally write the level of specificity that Jay Jones did in these texts, that shows that you're a pretty twisted human being.
I think so, too. But you've just kind of put this together for us here in St. Louis, because to me, it doesn't make sense. The racial aspect of the electorate makes a lot more sense. That explains it.
Oh,
so,
sure. You think about Hampton Roads, right? Richmond. There are some key constituents, like key voting blocks in Virginia that are critical to them winning. And if they don't do well with those, you know, that's like a Republican making inroads in Northern Virginia where I live, which is, you know, you're screwed. So they need that coalition to stick together. And look, if you look at the vote from last time when Governor Youngkin slipped in and you know, Winsome was lieutenant governor and then Jason Miar as our attorney general, it was not by a ton, right? Terry McAuliffe screwed up. This is, to me, the McAuliffe moment from 4 years ago, when McAuliffe at that point said parents shouldn't be involved
yep.
in their kids' education.
I remember that, yeah.
Well, this is the Jones moment, right?
It is.
And I think because of the closeness of this, and I'm telling you right now, I am going to tell you all three will win. Right now, Jason Miar is outside the margin area. He's up plus six. I think John Reed, who's the lieutenant governor candidate, he's in a dead tie. Winsome's down two. But the way that Abigail Spanberger is screwing this up so bad, because she's got word salads for this same issue, same problem she's having with the transgender issue, is that she refuses to actually discuss it because she knows how critical it is to her base. But she's alienating a lot of moms in Northern Virginia in particular who think this is nuts. So I'm just telling you, I think all three win. And I also think Jack Cittarelli in New Jersey pulls it out.
Wow, that's interesting. I love those predictions for sure. Sean Spicer back with us this afternoon. Let's talk about shutdown madness. When does this thing come to a close? I mean, it's almost like it's not even a story because of everything with Israel, but we're still here in this government shutdown with the blame game getting played back and forth.
So it's really interesting because just for your listeners there in St. Louis, I live, I don't know, 5 miles from the border of D.C. I've been through every government shutdown in modern history. In 1990, whatever it was, 5, 6, I was a staffer in the Senate and government got shut down. That was the Gingrich Clinton one. So I've been part of or around all of these. This is the least impactful government shutdown. Okay. And what I mean by that, Mark, is I normally would see it a lot more than most people. My neighbors work for the federal government. They're contractors or whatever. The way that this administration has kind of handled this, making sure that they're talking about people getting paid, they kept Smithsonian's open. Today's the first day the Smithsonian's will close, right? They've done a really good job of managing the shutdown, if you will. And so, one, that's important to know. Two, keep the date October 18th on your calendar. That is the day of the No Kings rally. Democrats cannot solve this shutdown until the rally's done because they have told their base that this is going to be this critical left-wing, you know, gathering. So they can't open the government until they have their stupid rally. That's just sad but true.
Wow.
And so I predicted it ends somewhere around 22, 23 October.
Yeah, which makes more sense, I guess, with that timeline that you just explained. So when it comes to Schumer in New York and all this AOC stuff, what are your thoughts on that? Obviously, he's got some, you know, political concerns moving forward. AOC seems to be kind of running the show on the Democrat side. He's afraid of alienating. But how do you see that kind of all playing out? Is that overstated, the Schumer aspect of this? No.
Oh, God, no. I mean, how would you like your entire career to possibly be overshadowed by this bartender, right? I mean, that's the reality. If you're Schumer, you have to, it's pretty pathetic to think that your entire life right now revolves around trying to defend your left flank against this, you know, gadfly. And that's frankly what she is. She does a really great job on social media, but this is not a serious policy person. And you are now letting her dictate the terms of everything that you're doing.
Yeah. And, you know, you have the legacy media that's right there with you and supporting. By the way, on that topic, I've got to get, I almost forgot about this. Good Lord. I've got to get your thoughts on the whole Barry Weiss Paramount deal with CBS News. I may be getting my hopes up a little bit too much on potential changes to the media landscape. But what are your thoughts on that? That's a pretty big deal.
It is. So people have to understand a couple things. So ABC, CBS and NBC are publicly broadcasters that use the public airways. And by law, they have an obligation to serve the public interest. It's funny how these, no one has cared at all about that, despite having, you know, three networks that are, you know, serve half of the country. But now Barry Weiss gets in there, they're talking about shaking stuff up, and suddenly it's the biggest threat to democracy we've ever seen. I'm excited about this. Listen, and also just keep in mind who Barry Weiss is. She is a left wing, now sort of come to, you know, thinker that has kind of come around based on how things have evolved in the past, you know, whatever, couple years, and watching her paper sort of be so close minded when she was at the New York Times and left, and then obviously was very successful in creating the Free Press. I just it's funny to me. It's like she escaped from a cult, and now everyone at the cult is afraid that she's going to tell everyone about the cult. I mean, that's how I see this whole thing, because it's to me hysterical why they're in such a panic. What are they afraid of? The left is, I honestly believe that. If you think about it, what are they afraid of on the left? Because it seems to me what they're really afraid of, when it really comes down to it, is they don't want her telling everyone else about how crazy they are. And that's why I truly believe it is like a cult.
Well, and then I don't know if you saw, I'm going to give a little bit more attention to this tomorrow because Jamie Reed is going to join us. But Jamie Reed was the whistleblower from here, Children's Hospital, and, you know, the transgender clinic. And that was in the Free Press when she wrote that piece in the Free Press. By the way, lesbian married to, you know, partner was trans, who now is detransitioning. And that was kind of the start of all this stuff falling apart, because then you had Tavistock overseas and a lot of things happened where, you know, they fell into place and people were horrified about what's happening to these kids. So you have John Oliver that goes on in... completely is tone deaf, a guy that I never thought was funny. He's on his monologue trying to take down that narrative of Jamie Reed, in particular, really just to beat up on Barry Weiss and the Free Press because they posted that particular piece. And it's hilarious, Sean, because one of the pieces of evidence that he uses that Jamie Reed's allegations were like not completely confirmed is he refers to a St. Louis Post-Dispatch piece in which, believe me, I read it and I ripped on it. They don't go to normal parents, right, in St. Louis that might be concerned. They go to the trans activists to get them to quote. And of course they're going to be outraged because they're trans activists.
Well, I mean, look, this whole issue to me, I'm like literally politically fascinated. And as like, I hope that like some political scientist in 20 years, when you are literally catering to the, I always call it the lowest common denominator. I feel bad for parents that deal with this or for people who are dealing with it because there's a problem and I want them to get help and I want them to not get tea. I don't think that should ever tease somebody that's going through some kind of personal issue. But at the same time, you don't cater, like there's a school near where I live, And the school has a uniform for girls and a uniform for boys. And this year, from what we were told by some friends whose kids are enrolled there, they're going to sort of a gender-neutral uniform for everyone because there was enrolling a transgender, and they didn't want them to feel offended. And I was like, so let me get this straight. The entire school is changing its entire uniform because one kid, and that's what I'm saying, like when I say the lowest common denominator, the Democratic Party is now, if one person is offended or wants something changed, everybody has to adhere to it. That's just nuts.
It is nuts, but that's exactly what they do. Sean Spicer, anything else you want to plug on the podcast?
Well, don't we? I mean, look, I always appreciate when people go to YouTube and sign up. We've got some great guests coming up this week. Glenn Beck's going to be with us. Eric Schmidt, the senator from Missouri.
I think I know him. I think I know him a little bit. Yeah.
I think you probably know him really well.
I do. He got his. You call him out. You say, I hear you had your humble beginnings on the Mark Reardon Show, and he'll confirm that. I promise you.
You know, yes. I will talk to him. By the way, you know, I think we talked about this before. I had a great hearing with him on Biden's mental decline. He's a really sharp guy. He was great as your attorney general. But then later in the week, we've got the Stephen K. Bannon joining the show as well. So this is going to be a big week for my show, whether you watch it on YouTube or X or Rumble or whatever. But the more people that subscribe to the audio version and to YouTube are as always greatly appreciated.
Awesome. Spicer, thank you so much. I always appreciate you coming on. Thank you. Take care.
Of course.
Hey, listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
John O'Leary's coming up here in a couple of minutes. He was going to join us on Friday, got stuck on an airplane. The movie about his life, Soul on Fire, opened up over the weekend. He is an executive producer as well. The story really is unbelievable. It's the thing that movies are made of, and he's going to join us here in a few minutes. Let me play a little bit of this John Oliver stuff. Jamie Reed, the whistleblower from WashU and Children's Hospital, who, by the way, you know, and this is what John Oliver's trying to do. He's trying to pick on Barry Weiss now that she leads CBS News. And this is a backhanded way of criticizing Barry, because when Jamie came out a couple years ago and wrote that piece that sort of made St. Louis a bit of what I like to call ground zero on this trans debate, it was in the Free Press at thefp.com. So they've kind of taken a side in all of that at the Free Press and saying, hey, all this information that was out there that people wanted to hide from you, well, now it's there. Jamie's telling the story. She once identified as queer. She no longer does that. She's a lesbian who is married to someone who is detransitioning. But and John Oliver is never anyone I thought is funny, but listen to the rant he goes on here.
I thought I was saving trans kids. Now I'm blowing the whistle. It's an account by Jamie Reed, who'd worked as a caseworker at the Washington University Transgender Center. Her piece claims that the clinic was harming patients by, among other things, routinely approving adolescents for medical transitions without proper mental health assessments, calling its work morally and medically appalling.
Now, let me stop right there and remind you that one of the children that came into that clinic was interested in having sex with dogs. And the instinct on the part of the professionals, the medical professionals who are in charge of gender-affirming care, decided that that young man wasn't mentally ill because he wanted to have sex with dogs, but that he should be hopped up on puberty blockers and perhaps have his penis cut off. That's what they were doing, John Oliver. So just keep that in mind. Well, where'd my audio go? Here it is.
Which prompted Weiss to go on Megyn Kelly's podcast to take something of a victory lap.
The day after the piece published, I've never seen such a sort of rapid reaction to a piece of journalism. Missouri's attorney general announced an investigation into the gender clinic. The reason that this story was especially important and gratifying for us to have substantiated was because it's exactly the kind of story that we exist to pursue.
Now, she's right about that, but John goes on to lie about a lot of different things here, because what people have to recognize, and he does not share with his audience, is that Jamie Reed in that piece in the Free Press, that was the beginning. That was the beginning of everything that happened. Then you go across the pond to Tavistock and the clinic, where they had to admit that this is harming kids. Europe way ahead of us on this trans issue. By the way, Sue, this is interesting, and I haven't talked about it yet, but went to Rosalita Saturday night, had two of Alexa's friends. They're in the back seat, right? Becky's talking to me. I'm trying to ignore her because I'm trying to eavesdrop on the back seat where one of the girls is talking about someone who is clearly a boy that is acting like a girl. And I hear the other little girl, not my daughter, say, was that transgender? So these kids, they know. Oh, I mean, gosh. I haven't had this discussion with my daughter, but they know what this is all about. But he goes on to lie about all this stuff.
It's exactly the kind of morally naughty story in which journalists avoid pursuing it because they know they will be punished or smeared for doing so.
That is exactly right. That's exactly why no one had the courage to do a story like that.
That is why the free press exists.
Wow, that is an exceptional amount of self-congratulation. And the bar was already set at the Jerry Maguire moment heard around the world. But she is right. The state AG apparently found that article, to borrow a term, riveting, because they soon announced an investigation into the center, and it ultimately stopped treating minors, with Reed's claims even being used to help justify a statewide ban on gender-affirming care for them. So it did have real impact, which is what makes it so awkward that when Washington University conducted its own investigation, they found that allegations of substandard care causing adverse outcomes for patients at the center were unsubstantiated.
Okay, a bunch of crap. And he goes on, and here's John Oliver in an age where, again, I'm going to put the number at 97% of the people in this country are sick and tired, not only about hearing about trans people, but about having them try to take the spots of little girls and women on teams across this nation. You want to be trans, you want to cut your breasts off, you want to cut your penis off, you want to do whatever you want, go for it. Stay away from our kids. That was Jamie Reed's entire point.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, I played this song the other day. It is the song that runs on the end credits of the movie Soul on Fire. It's a damn good song, too, I gotta tell you.
God, I'm running for your heart.
This is the story of John O'Leary, St. Louis native, who, when he was 9 years old, set himself on fire.
I know what it feels like to think you've probably thrown your life away.
To move through the adversities of life, we must have a reason to thrive that is bigger than all the challenges that we face.
The most powerful weapon on earth is the human soul on fire.
Yeah, that's Joel Courtney, who does a great job of playing Mr. O'Leary, who is with us on the phone tonight on 97.1 FM Talk on the Cloud 9 that has to be beyond all Cloud 9s. John, how are you tonight?
Mark Reardon, you put me in a good mood, man. I am doing great right now.
I loved Joel's performance because he really nailed your mannerisms, and I think I said this on Friday, too. I said, I don't think I've ever seen John O'Leary when he's not smiling. And I mean, like, smiling ear to ear. That's what I think about when I think of you, John.
Yeah, you know, Bloody Marys in the morning help get the day off, right?
It,
and just keep
it.
That going throughout the day. And it puts a smile on your face, Reardon.
Well, I want to talk about you right now. I don't want to talk about the movie in the particulars because what happens, I want people to see this story if they're not familiar with it. I do have a couple of questions just because I was curious, and you've shared your story a lot of times. But is it true just from the public speaking standpoint that you were invited when you were younger to go to this Girl Scout meeting. You had someone invite you and say, hey, your story seems appealing. Would you like to come and speak? And this is portrayed in the movie as a very awkward moment. So did that really happen? Is that how the, you know, the whole public speaking gig started?
So we can answer that question and a whole bunch of others probably by just saying that film is real life, man.
Yeah.
They filmed the scenes where I was burned at my mom and dad's house. They filmed the place where I was married at the Shrine of St. Joseph. The scenes from Busch Stadium, of course, were shot down there. The conversations are accurate. And yeah, man, I was working construction at age 28, and a Girl Scout troop leader named Deanna pulls up at a construction site, invites me to speak. And almost on a dare, I said yes. In the film, it shows me speaking to 6 Girl Scouts. In real life, it was 3. And I think in the film, they gave me a lot more credit for how successful I was in the remarks. And he was not very successful in it, man. It was a lousy first keynote.
Yeah.
But you got to start somewhere. So that was the first deal.
That is amazing. Now, you're also an executive producer on this film. You're around the set all the time. Just talk about the last few weeks, John. I know there were a lot of screenings here in St. Louis, getting people excited, word-of-mouth screenings, but you had a big red carpet. There's been a lot of attention. What has your life been like the last few weeks?
Kind of a blur, a little bit of a sprint. I've been more familiar with flight attendants and pilots than my own children and wife over the last month or so. We've just been a lot of time on the road. It's a national release, so a lot of time in New York and LA and around the country. But man, my heart's for St. Louis. And yeah. So when they gave the mandate that the premiere would be in LA, I fought back and said, we've got to have it in St. Louis. And so we did do it in St. Louis, and we rolled out, part of the metaphor, we rolled out the red carpet in a mighty way. 2,300 people at the Powell. California, New York media came in for it, and they saw what makes St. Louis so special, man. I mean, Brennan, it was an incredible fest of celebrating our community, our story, our lives, and the truth that we're better than sometimes we claim.
I was trying to think of a movie that is more St. Louis-centric, just with the visuals and everything about St. Louis. I don't know if one really exists. And it's great to have a moment where you can kind of be proud of St. Louis and everything around here. How many times have you seen the film?
So it's been through a bunch of iterations. So I've probably seen it about 100 times in its final iteration. So eventually Sony picks it up, they make a few more tweaks, and then they roll it out.
Yeah.
And in that iteration, I've probably seen it a dozen times.
So in that situation with the movie company, are they, once they pick up distribution, can they make decisions above what you think the decision should be made? Is that how it works?
They were sweet, Mark. They were very collaborative. And ultimately, they do get the final say. But there were several scenes that they wanted to cut, and I argued back, and they listened. They wanted, we said this earlier, they wanted to do the premiere in L.A. We argued back, and they listened. So I found them to be actually really humble and willing to listen to ideas that might be better than the ones they were putting forward.
So one of the things I think they made, I'm going to take a guess here, just because, as you know, I was in the film critic world for a long time. It doesn't seem like they screened it for critics. So if you go on Rotten Tomatoes, for example, there's not a Rotten Tomatoes score. However, if you look at the audience score, it's like 98%. So who needs the critics, right, John?
Well, you know, so that's a cool thing. Last weekend, Tron was the number one movie in the nation. Good for Tron. And they put $150 million to make it so. We are a far smaller budget film, and we are the number 5 movie in the nation, which is pretty doggone cool.
Yeah.
Number 5 movie in the country is filmed right here in St. Louis, celebrating the great city of St. Louis and the stories that take place here. But more than that, the number 1 ranked audience film last weekend was not Tron or a million other films that showed up. It was Soul on Fire. And so this movie does move people. You're starting to see a few more critics show up. It's about a 70% critic that like it so far. So they are leaning toward liking this thing. But Mark, I'm not after the critics, man.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to impress them. We are after people. We're after lives. I've been so floored that not only middle-aged folks like you and I love this film, our parents love this film, our children love this film. When you stand in the back of a theater and you watch people leave, they laugh, they cry, they clap, and they walk out of there changed. And that's true across every demographic.
Look, I experienced this. You know, I sent you this picture before my daughter and I saw the film on Thursday night from Ronnie's, and she really loved it, and we talked about it. We had a conversation with it after, you know, after we saw the movie, and about the messaging of making your life matter, because that's the overriding message here. And, you know, I have to ask you this question, because I have a friend who is in town over the weekend who has a daughter who's battled cancer a couple of times. She's 16 years old right now. She had a terrible first battle, and then she recovered. And then she woke up about a year and a half ago, and she couldn't even move her legs. She was paralyzed, and, you know, she came back in both particular instances. But one of the things that my friend told me, and, you know, he's very familiar with your story and wants Kira, her, his daughter, to see the film, is that she's not as motivated about her own recovery right now. I think maybe there's a little depression involved, and she's not doing, in the parents' opinion, the hard work to improve her strength and stamina. You had a situation right where you were in a lot of pain. So what do you say to a little girl like that who's gone through hell and back? And I think of people like her, and I think of people like you and my friend Chris Smith, who you've gotten to know, who have been shot in the head, yeah, and have gone through a lot more damaging things than I probably ever will. But how do you talk to a kid who maybe at times wants to give up, like you probably did, John, and motivate right them to go on with the rest of their life?
Well, I'll answer that. But first, my favorite part about the film is John O'Leary is not a hero in the film Soul on Fire. In fact, if there's one fool in it, his name is John. Everyone else who shows up are the heroes. And so I love the fact that you're not cheering for a burn survivor. You're cheering for the nurse, and you're cheering for his siblings, and you're cheering for this pretty girlfriend of his. And it's everybody else that you get behind. And so when you ask that question about this little girl, man, I think my first encouragement would be to the parents to just keep loving her where she is, as she is, to have faith that eventually she will hit bottom and then bounce forward. But you got to be there for her when that happens. And then as they bring me back in to meet her, I want to try to motivate her out of her slump. I think it's important in life just to meet people where they are, to listen to them, to grieve with them, to be angry with them for a while. And then once you've earned their trust, and that takes a little bit, that's when you're going to have courageous conversations about, like, man, where are we? What does tomorrow look like? What's it going to take to get there? And what do you have to do right now in order to take the next right step? But, Mark, I was, after I got burns, man, I didn't come through this thing without scars on the inside or outside. Yeah. I wrestled with that for 20 years before I started really building up my life. And so if this little girl who has just been through the worst wants to wrestle for a while in the mud, I would join her and not try to rise her out of that wake. I would be there with her in it and then give her some time and space to figure out what she really wants to do next.
So one question I've always wanted to ask you, maybe I have, but you know, you come away from the movie, you don't see, your parents are always supportive. They say, John, it's up to you if you're going to live, right? There's scenes in the movie. But was there ever a period, and I ask this seriously, where your dad or your mom said, what the hell were you thinking, kid playing with fire in that garage?
You know, it's funny, man. If I missed curfew by 2 minutes, I was crushed. I mean, my life was ruined when I did little things. Then you burn down the family home and you don't get in any trouble ever. So I don't understand how my parents parented.
Yeah.
But here's what I think they got right. They made the big things, and the little things, the little things. And when John hit rock bottom, they were there to guide him forward. They gave me tough love, which in the film comes across as learning how at one point to pick up your own fork, learning how when you don't have fingers to start playing the piano.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Learning how when you don't feel like extending your hand to meet somebody else, to shake their hand and grab them and pull them in like I've done with you, Mark, so many times.
Hugging it out. I know you have. Right.
All these things that I've become in my life are the result of parents who would not let me make excuses.
And that movie was dedicated to your father at the end, I believe, wasn't it?
Well, there's a reason for that. And, you know, the movie ends. I think the most moving scene in the entire film is the final scene.
It is.
So I'll have your listeners go to check that out. But a scene a few before that is at the wedding when John, you know, I'll give away the ending. John gets married. He has a couple kids. Good for him. But they get married, man. And in the second row is my actual father. And Mark, my dad, as you know, has Parkinson's disease, was unable to stand for 20 years or so. But when Sean McNamara, the director of Reagan and Soul Surfer and now Soul on Fire, yelled the word action, my heroic dad, a veteran, stands up and you see him in this movie, man, with this resolute bit of joy on his face. And so we lost my dad on May 30th. And every single time I watch this scene shot in the Shrine of St. Joseph, as the girl playing my wife is actually wearing my wife's wedding dress, walks down the aisle, and they dolly left, I look at this second row, second aisle, and there's my dad showing us what real courage looks like. It's not easy in life to step up, to pull your shoulders back, but that's the invitation. And my dad answered every day of his life.
I've just had chills for like 60 seconds straight, John O'Leary, hearing you tell that story. That is amazing. Congratulations on this project. I love your brother. You know that. This is an important film to see. And I'm so glad you're having so much success. And I told, you know, the young actor, Spencer Davis Milford, who plays your roommate and best friend, you had him pinch hit for you on Friday because you were on that airplane. He was fantastic. he was really, really talented.
And, he's a stud.
Yeah, and you put a great cast together, so I'm glad that everything is working out. But one thing I told Spencer, and I think you'll understand this, I said, Spencer, do you know the term outkicked your coverage? And he said, yes. I said, man, with Beth, John O'Leary really outkicked his coverage, didn't he? He agreed with me when I defined it for him. And I mean that, John. Say hi to your wife, too. Thanks so much for coming on tonight.
Reardon, you and I have radio faces, man. So we did this live together, buddy. You're
right
with me.
We'll have you on again soon. Thanks, John O'Leary. Take care.
Thank you, Mark.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
All right, went too long with John O'Leary, which I'm so happy I did because that was an amazing story told about his dad. But audio cut of the day, Middle East peace, Donald J. Trump.
This is not only the end of a war. This is the end of an age of terror and death and the beginning of the age of faith and hope and of God. It's the start of a grand concord and lasting harmony for Israel and all the nations of what will soon be a truly magnificent region. I believe that so strongly. This is the historic dawn of a new Middle East.
He signed the peace accord this morning.
This took 3,000 years to get to this point. Can you believe it? And it's going to hold up, too. It's going to hold up. Okay, thank you.
That's the important part. Let's see if it holds up. But a big, big day in the hostages' return, at least the ones who are alive. They're still looking for, unfortunately, some of the bodies of the dead hostages. That is your audio cut of the day.
Get more at 971talk.com.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah, you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.